Got your coffee?
All right, great.
Happy with the coffee? Want some sugar?
Sure, I'll take a sugar.
All right. Pick any sugar packet.
All right.
Do you feel like a free choice?
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead and put that down. Check out this quarter.
Yeah, looks good to me.
All right. Put it on top of the sugar packet. All right, this is what I like to do in every coffee house. Ready? I'm just gonna go and wave my hand over it, and then.
Wow, that was really impressive, actually.
Go ahead and inspect that sugar packet one more time.
Okay.
Sealed?
Yeah.
Unopened?
Yeah.
Free choice, right?
Yeah.
Why don't you tear that open? And pour everything out.
Oh, wow. Well, we weren't planning on talking about magic, but that is pretty damn impressive.
Yeah. Thanks again for your ATM PIN code and social security number and all the things you didn't realize you were giving me.
I like it. Social engineering has evolved. We don't have to ask you for your password. Steve just comes and takes it from you magically.
Oh, yeah.
Wow. Well, that is... That's pretty cool. I want to know how that happened, but I know I will never find out and I will be amazed. That is really cool.
Yeah, it's the same way people don't understand how a threat actor got a hold of their password.
Wow.
You never see it coming.
Wow.
That's the scary part.
Welcome everyone to another edition of CISO to CISO. I'm your host, Michael Coates, CEO and co-founder of Altitude Networks, formerly CISO of Twitter, as I like to say, a reason why I get to be here with esteemed CISOs. And today we have Steve Tran, CISO of MGM Studios, who's gonna join us for a great discussion on cybersecurity. Thank you, thanks for having us here today and thanks for the time.
Excited to be here to have a fun conversation about the complexity and challenges of our job, especially in Hollywood.
Yeah, exactly. Well, for those of you that have watched us before, you've probably recognized that we're often virtually on location, but today we're actually somewhere for real, unless people think this is just the best virtual background ever.
Yeah.
But where are we, Steve? You alluded to it there.
Yeah, we're in Hollywood. This is where your favorite television shows and movies are made.
I think it's a very apropos location. I mean, you're located here with MGM Studios. And so it's actually really great to blend the cybersecurity world that we're gonna talk about with the world you live and breathe in every single day. And I certainly have a renewed appreciation for it, looking around and everything that goes into these things.
I don't think a lot of people realize how much work it takes to produce a television series or a film. There's all sorts of different categories, even within production. You got miniseries, you got short form content, you got indie films, you got documentaries, all sorts of content being generated right now and being distributed in so many different ways. You got traditional broadcast television, you got streaming, and then you have theatrical, you got the theater, the movie theaters.
And so, as I'm thinking about what you're saying from a cybersecurity perspective, and I know this is your world, so you think about this all the time, but I'm hearing critical data, like multiple different distribution channels, different formats, different stakeholders. It sounds challenging. If I was to only imagine the things you have to deal with in your role, kind of backing up a little bit, how did you get to your role? How did you end up as CISO of MGM Studios? That's a pretty dang cool role.
Yeah, I think I social engineered my way into the role. No, but in all reality, I had a media pedigree. I had experience in technology and security for a long time before I came across this opportunity to implement a security risk management program for this iconic organization. I mean, when I first started my career, it was over 20 years ago, mm-hmm. totally by accident. When AOL first came out, I'm like, what's the internet? What's AOL, right? Next thing I knew, I was dabbling in Hasta La Vista. I was playing around with Sub 7, Trojans as a prank with my friends, because I was just trying to find ways for them to download the malware, essentially the Trojan, so that I can pretend to possess their computer and open their CD-ROM.
Oh wow!
I at random, that. Right? Yep. There's yep. I remember in the GUI, I think it was made in Visual Basic. So there's a button you just push, and you can control their CD-ROM drive and other parts of the computer, like keylogging, right? I just never thought it would turn into a career, though. People were still trying to embrace the internet and the possibilities of what we could do with the internet. Back then, no one thought about, oh, we can use the internet to distribute content. Now you got HD, 4K, right? Mm-hmm. So the amount of content being delivered over the internet now is astronomical. Like, I don't know if the internet was built to handle that much bandwidth. I think over the years, I found myself getting a lot of experience in a lot of different industries where we slowly started to realize that security and risk is becoming a complex problem and challenge that needed to be solved. Mm-hmm. And here we are, fast forward into the future, we're still trying to figure out because of the ever-changing dynamic nature of risk.
I totally agree. It's amazing how much the field has changed in such a short period of time. You know, sometimes you think about other fields that have hundreds or many hundreds of years of kind of case studies. You know, they've been evolving for so much time. Think of structural engineering, think of the medicine, medical fields. And here we are, like, go back 10 years ago and the whole world of technology is totally different. Go back 20 years ago and you're thinking about bulletin board, dial-up. And it's fascinating how much we've all made our way through that. And the world is just so dramatically different today. I think your point about the massive amount of data is spot on. You know, my most recent role was CISO at Twitter, and thinking about real-time systems and how much smaller bits of data, but real-time, and what that means for security and how you have to think about security and within milliseconds to be able to do things, or it's too slow, and just fascinating. Now, you mentioned the different types of data and the different ways things are distributed. You must have lots of interesting challenges in your role. What are some of the things you have to think about that might be, you know, unique to your position in addition to all the other stuff you already have?
Yeah, I think before I began doing this type of work for media entertainment, I don't think I had the level of appreciation as I do now for how this whole industry worked, because I started off my career in law enforcement working ID theft, fraud, abuse, computer crime, mm-hmm. which set the foundation for me to be successful in the commercial side. And on the commercial side, I've worked for a toy company, I've worked for a Big Four, and when I stumbled at Fox, that was a real eye-opening experience because I got to work in live broadcast and television, live sports, and I got to work on the lot. So mm-hmm. being the curious person that I am, right? I just like to be in everyone's business because that's what it's like to be in security. You have to be nosy. You have to know what's going on in order to protect, you know, whatever it is that you've discovered that is, you know, a gap, right? Or a vulnerability that a threat can exploit. So walking around the studio a lot, I got to, and being a social person that I am too, being a magician and everything, hey, you wanna see a magic trick? Hey, you know, uh-huh. let's see, what's your name? What do you do, uh-huh. right? So I got to meet all sorts of people in production, you know, people for behind the camera, grip, craft services. I really miss craft services. and seeing, you know, how everyone comes together as a team to create this story that they want to share with the world. And when I think about what I'm really doing here is I'm really protecting the creatives and the storytellers mm-hmm. so that we can tell inspiring and uplifting stories to various communities. Because a lot of these stories need to be told. And you know, everyone's putting out a lot of great stuff in the world. And when we are able to protect that, we're really securing also the brand, the reputation, the revenue, right? And the content, because that's the value. So as I'm learning more about how production works and getting involved too, I mean, there were times where I had to jump on an airplane with less than 8 hours notice to go to a live sporting event with two Cisco ASA firewalls in hand. And like, imagine going to TSA, right? You're thinking about like post 9/11, I'm walking in through TSA with two giant Cisco ASA firewalls, right? Because we need to get on site, set the technology up so that we can distribute it back to the studio and then back on air and then the different teams. You got a team that works on sound, you got a team that works on animation, transition, replays. So how do you secure not only the asset and the data itself, but the motion of it? Just with this one example, you could already see the complexity. So the complexity exists even on television production and film production. And if you think it's complex for one production, imagine managing many productions, right? Studios have different slates and the amount of films they have slated for the year or the next couple of years. And then also if they're producing television shows and yeah, how many shows are going on at one time during the season. Think about it this way. At the end of every movie, you see the end credits and they seem to go on forever, right? That's how many people it takes to produce that particular film. Mm-hmm. Not everyone is a full-time employee. There's a lot of contractors, freelancers in there as well. That was a long end credit for just this film. Now imagine having to manage multiple film productions and television production that have the same amount of people working on it. That's why I love my job so much, is because I'm protecting, you know, everyone's work, because they put their time, heart and soul into this creation of their story, that I don't want to let them down. I don't want, you know, their livelihoods to be impacted. And we're just trying to protect that economy. Because there's a lot of people out there that want to sneak peek in the upcoming tentpole movies, or they want to know what happens after that crazy cliffhanger in season one or two, whatever, you know, just, and there's just people that just don't want to pay for the content. They just want the free content, but they don't realize that it takes a lot of people to make that content, and we want to make sure they get paid.
What I love about what you're saying is that when you think about cybersecurity, people often immediately go to the, oh, the zero day, the buffer overflow, et cetera, et cetera. And you talked entirely about like business and the moving parts and the value of the company. And I think that's where security leadership is understanding the big picture of where this all comes together and why you're doing what you are. And I love that. And you know, we were talking beforehand, there's a really interesting transition that you make in your career from technical at its beginnings, like very focused on technical, to as you continue to grow, exactly what you're talking about as a leader. Like, this is why it matters to the business and what we're doing and what we're enabling. But at the same time, it sounds like you also keep your hands pretty close to the tech. If I remember right, you were just recently in a competition at DEF CON with your team.
Right.
Yeah, tell us about that.
So being a former engineer myself, and it's crazy because I never thought I would be a CISO one day, because I loved being hands-on and being an engineer, just being in the weeds of things. Yep. But as I got older and as I matured throughout my career, I started to realize what my passion is. And my passion is really creating and preserving opportunities for others. What better way to do that than to help build, coach, and mentor a team of brand new security professionals? When I hear about the cybersecurity talent shortage or the difficulties of hiring, I think about how we are, what our current hiring practices are and how we can improve on that. So for me personally, I looked at the requirements and found ways to lower that barrier. And once we've lowered that barrier, we started to really find amazing candidates. And when we hired these amazing candidates, after we lowered the barrier to entry, We got them involved in DEF CON.
Because for me, I've been going to DEF CON for many years, and I love it because
there's always something to learn, right? I consider myself a lifelong learner.
Yep.
So if I'm gonna be, you know, a great security, if I wanna be a great security leader, I wanna make sure that I'm constantly learning myself, right? Because I have the expectation that the team should be doing the same thing as having that thirst for knowledge and hunger, right? So it's our tradition to go to DEF CON every year to have fun, right? It's a great team building exercise. We get to learn new things and we get to show off our skills and show off what we've learned. And one of the ways to do that are the CTF contests that DEF CON hosts every year. So this past year, or actually last month.
just a few weeks ago, exactly.
We competed in a CTF contest in the Blue Team Village. And we had two brand new hires do really well. And out of 246 show participants, 90 teams, they finished in 26th place.
Wow.
Typically, I get to help out quite a bit with the scoring, but in this past one, I didn't help out as much because I was flying over the Pacific Ocean to Hawaii. So imagine trying to do the CTF contest on airplane Wi-Fi over the Pacific. I mean, what, the airplane's going like over 350 miles per hour, so I'm just like thinking physics, right? I'm like, wow, that latency is crazy. So I did the best I could to help them out, but I think what was more gratifying was the fact that I wasn't there, they did it on their own, and they really went up against the best out there and solidified their place within the industry. Don't tell me, you know, we need candidates that have a four-year degree in cybersecurity and a buttload of certs. I mean,
yeah, it sounds like a really smart approach, because if I was reading between the lines, you're looking for people with aptitude and teaching and mentoring them. And, you know, what better way to do that? I've found through my own teams that I've built over the years that some of the best people in the team, they didn't necessarily have a, quote, traditional degree or this or that. In fact, they often worked very unique jobs. I remember someone that I worked with that was particularly good, and he told me the story about how he used to manage a farm and all the different complexities of the people working at the farm, unrelated to security, but it demonstrated his ability to think in a unique situation with lots of moving parts, imperfect information, which those skills translated really well. I'm glad to see more thinking around how do we get, you know, the next generation of people into the field and breaking down those barriers. That's awesome. Now, as you're thinking about the challenges that you have to face in your role, you know, it just keeps changing out from under us. Just like we were talking about earlier, technology keeps changing. The last year or two has changed dramatically. We thought we were all making a general shift into cloud enablement, and then one day we all were at home instantly. Work from home was a sudden thing for everyone. How has that change in technology and the adoption of cloud, how have you thought about those things as you approach it from a security program?
A while ago, what I've learned, because we've all been through bumps and bruises, right? Mm-hmm. We all have bumps and bruises. There's a lot of lessons learned. The longer anyone has been doing this, the more bumps and bruises they're gonna have. And what I realized one day was what you knew a year ago or 2 years ago may not even be relevant today or in the next few years. So I went from having the anxiety of just having to retain so much knowledge, right, as each year goes on, and not forgetting it, to, you know what, I'm just gonna not stress too much about it, accepting the fact that what we may know a year ago or a few years ago will no longer apply today. And that thinking helped me shift into another mindset, which is to always embrace change and don't be fearful of that change, because if we are, especially in this field, it doesn't allow us to help enable the business, because what we're constantly doing is trying to retain a one-size-fits-all or maybe monolithic approach to reducing risk. So what I do is, you know, as technology evolves and becomes more sophisticated, I embrace that. And I want to be a part of that growth early on, because the sooner you can be a part of anything new, the easier it becomes, you know, later on the back end when you're now responsible for addressing the security risks or issues with whatever technology, right? Rather than playing catch up. So the way I think about as technology changes is like I'm always on the forefront as it's happening myself, and not telling myself, oh, I'll get to it when it becomes a problem, or now is not a good time. So the sooner you can get involved in new technology, the more effective you can be in influencing the security recommendations and fixes ahead of time before, you know, it becomes a problem.
Yeah, you know, what I like about that thinking is I think there's a lot of people out there that are aspiring for leadership roles one day in their future. And I think it can be paralyzing to say, how could I possibly know enough or know about all these different fields? And it almost contributes, I think, to people's, you know, imposter syndrome. And the key that you're saying there is have a framework, have a way of thinking about it, you know, lean into these new technologies. You're gonna figure it out. And don't worry, everyone doesn't know all the things, but you'll get there. I like that a lot. Now, one of the newer challenges that I know you and everyone is facing is with cloud adoption, these platforms for collaboration and sharing. And in particular, I know you've brought in Altitude Networks at MGM Studios to help you out. Tell us a little bit about, you know, what led to that decision-making. What problems were you looking to solve there?
Yeah, I just remember when cloud first entered the scene, people were very hesitant about it. I think there was some skepticism whether or not cloud would be widely adopted or if it would be secure enough. Fast forward to today, it's a great business model, market solution for so many different size companies and industries. And it's even created modernized security services and solutions, things I wish I would have had back then. So when you think about, you know, cloud collaboration today and why I felt Altitude was so compelling for us was the fact that I went from how everyone else did DLP, right? It's like, hey, here's the asset. We need to lock this down based on the data classification. And that's it. It's a one size fit all. But then when you look at our business and what we talked about earlier is, you know, the complexity of how everyone works, right? And how data needs to be shared amongst, you know, full-time employees, non-full-time employees, so many different third parties, right? And we know third party risk is a big deal now. That weren't talked about even 5 years ago. I mean, people were talking about it, but it wasn't, you know, news breaking as it is today because of the recent, you know, issues that we've seen on the news when it comes to, you know, third party risk. So for me, I went from, all right, we're gonna take on this unrealistic losing battle of trying to secure it ourselves and lock it down ourselves because we're security, that's what we're supposed to do, right? To, all right, we want to move towards a model where we want the users, the employees, the essentially the data owners, to be more accountable for how they not only generate their data, but then how they store it and share it as well. And if it needs to be fixed or remediated because it's exposed when it shouldn't be, should that be our responsibility as a security team? I don't think so anymore. I think it should be the responsibility of the person who created that data. And then that shifts into other approaches that we may have traditionally taken when we rely on certain things from the user, like don't click on bad links, look at the email header, spot this thing. I mean, we got artists, we got creative people who have no idea what an email header looks like, right? So why are we going to expect them to dissect the email header and look for all these things, right? That's our job. So by being a little bit more intelligent and targeted on what we expect of the user, we're able to identify what we can take off their plate so that whatever is left on their plate is more effective. So instead of having them examine email headers for different phishing scams or spoofing, you know, we implement technology and machine learning so that they don't even get exposed to those types of threats to begin with. And, you know, same with the clicking, right? You know, we're going to only have awareness training and teach them not to click on things, but they're going to do it. So do we have a mechanism in place to do URL rewriting, sandbox detonation before it actually, you know, does something malicious? So when we kind of extract a lot of those unrealistic expectations on the users, then whatever's left is achievable, in my opinion, right? So when it comes to DLP, as an example, with the data, the reporting, the metrics that I'm getting back from the platform, gives us that not only visibility, but it tells a better story of intent. Mm-hmm. And when I understand what the user's intent is, we're able to come up with better recommendation solutions for them, where they can feel empowered now to rectify these security risks.
Well, that's great. As you're using the product, are there any particular features or use cases that you found like, wow, I'm actually surprised this finally exists today?
Yeah, so when you look at traditional CASB, right, because we've seen them, where I felt like it was just very asset heavy, mm-hmm. right? And I couldn't really contextualize it without having to exert a lot of brain power to make it useful. I mean, I think having something is better than nothing, obviously, right? So, you know, that visibility was great, but then we needed to take it to the next level. Not only having that visibility, but understanding the relationships mm-hmm. between other employees, partners outside of the company, contractors, freelancers, and even third-party sharing authentication, right? Because when you think about OAuth as an example, it makes it really easy to federate one SaaS service to another. And you're just like, wow, like, are we thinking about the residual risk as the data keeps getting branched out and shared in so many different vectors that in some areas we may have control over and visibility, in some areas where we don't. And that's the scary part, because we can't protect something we don't know exists or see. So I was really impressed by the level of reporting and relationship mapping to help us track down how these assets are being shared and what we could do about it.
Yeah, that's one of the things that we found fascinating as we kept exploring the space and the technology that we could build, was the notion that, okay, you can share to an account, that account turns out to be an external account, and then, yeah, tying it back with the relationship to the employee. Okay, so now we know that. But then there's a whole other category where a company is working on a document and they never realize that the document's not even owned by an employee. It was created by an outside individual, shared back into the company. Everyone's just been working away on it. And then one day maybe that person leaves and they delete the file and everyone's like, where did it go? There's no log of it anywhere because it was created outside by a personal account or a third party. The new challenges are amazing, all the different things to think about. One of the things that's been interesting in building a company, especially a company that initially I was motivated to create because I wanted to buy that solution myself at Twitter and it didn't exist, is that when people are seeing it for the first time, they're like, well, aren't you just something else? Aren't you just a traditional DLP? Or aren't you just a CASB? And of course we explain why we're different and the role we play and then they get it. But you had the opportunity to actually have that cut and dry in front of you. You actually have another CASB solution that you've used for different purposes. What was it like to see how we operated versus the capabilities you had in a CASB?
Yeah, it was a night and day difference. What we had before only showed us the different assets that were either publicly exposed or shared with an external party, but requires authentication, so based on the rules, right? And that was the extent of it. So really, it behaved based on what we wanted it to do. It's helpful sometimes, but there are times where it would be nice if the solution can help educate us a little bit more. Because the way I look at it is we are the security practitioners that solve the risk problems, right? Vendors and toolings, they don't solve the problem. They help, But it's up to the security professional and practitioners to solve the risk issues and problems. What we noticed was we had this incumbent tool that was just very rigid. It was just like, here's the asset and this is how it's shared. That's it, right? In terms of like, yeah, it has a public link. It doesn't have a public link, but that was it. It didn't have any residual data to show that, hey, this is where it originated, right? Because I think, you know, the way it presented the results could be misleading because it may look like this particular user who touched it last created it, but that wasn't reality. Reality was, to your point, right? It's like, how did this data get into our environment? Was it something we generated? Was it something a third party generated, right? Sometimes you don't know because all of a sudden you just look at a report and it's like you have millions and millions of assets. Mm-hmm. And we can't assume that we created them all, right? So based on the tooling that we had, I didn't have that high level of assurance that it gave us accurate information. Mm-hmm. When we switched to your tool, what I loved about it was you retroactively created a trail that we didn't expect. Mm-hmm. And I think another thing we didn't expect because, you know, user-centric risk modeling is part of our strategy. And what I liked about Altitude was it focused heavily on identity. Who is this person? What do they do? Mm-hmm. And how do they share information, right? And when you figure out how they share information with other people, then you start doing a profile on the people they're collaborating with. Who are they? What do they do? Mm-hmm. And then you can put a more accurate story together. Oh, it's because they work in, you know, this role. So it's expected that they're going to collaborate with mm-hmm. these other people that have similar roles or, you know, we can rely on other data to show, oh yeah, that's normal that these two groups would be constantly collaborating with each other, even though you may look at it in a meeting and not connect the dots because it just, you don't want to make assumptions, right? Don't judge a book by its cover, but you know, when you really rely on the data and make data-driven decisions, you can understand the relationships. Mm-hmm. And I think that was really key, is just understanding intent, relationship, right? That's the context that helps us provide, again, better recommendations and solutions because we know that whatever recommendations and solutions we deploy out there, it's going to be customized to their needs versus, hey, you're here to make our lives easier. This is why we signed up for this type of job, right? It's almost like when I was in law enforcement, right? We signed up because we had a strong desire to protect and serve, no matter how inconvenient it would be on us. You know, the amount of family events I missed, birthdays that I missed, like, you know, we make those sacrifices for the greater good, to fight the good fight. So I take that same mentality into this role and everything that we do, we should be relentless on how do we make it easier on the business while reducing and addressing the risk.
What I love about what you said in there is it touches on the nuances and the interesting challenges we face at security now, which is how the business works. It's not the old days where it's like the port is open or the port is closed. There's a vulnerability, there's not. Now it's like sharing is not inherently bad. Sharing outside the business is not inherently bad, but you could through accident share to the wrong people. You could through malice purposely expose documents the wrong way. And so I'm glad to hear you're really diving and saying like, all right, how does a business need to operate? How can we enable and empower that? That's really awesome. Now, since you've been using the solution for quite some time, who would you recommend it to? What kind of companies could benefit from the Altitude Networks solution?
I would say anyone that relies heavily on collaboration and sharing and multi-cloud. We have people who love Box and we have people that don't love Box. We have people that love Google Drive and we have people that don't like Google Drive. The reality is many organizations have multi-solutions in the same category. So what I like about Altitude, it was your compatibility with different services that exist out there. And for, you know, businesses that require optionality, right? This is a great solution for that because you provide coverage for various options rather than just one option. Awesome. And it's cloud native. That's the best part, right? There's no agents that you need to install. Mm-hmm. You're going straight to the source because the APIs are there, right? Mm-hmm. It's not magic. We want to go straight to a source. We don't want to play this man in the middle game. Yeah. To security,
yeah,
right?
I'm with you.
Because that just introduces more complexity. So we're no better than anyone else where, you know, they're introducing complexity because we know that every time we add complexity, those are risk points.
Well, Steve, we've covered a lot of ground, but one thing I like to try and ask everybody when I have this chance is, what is the advice you would give to the next generation of security leaders, the people that are entering the field and aspire to be in your shoes one day, aspire to lead security? Is there anything you want to leave them with besides all the great nuggets you've already shared?
Yeah, I would say, don't be afraid to challenge the status quo. Mm-hmm. Be open-minded and don't be afraid to just pull up a chair and sit at the table, even if it's not readily available to you or mm-hmm. as easily invited. Sometimes you just have to go in there and do it because people don't know what they don't know. So if you're able to create your own opportunities, that could be, you know, life-changing rather than just waiting for opportunities to fall into your lap. And again, I guess that's something I've always practiced, but not realizing it because I'm very passionate. So mm-hmm. I just go and I just, you know, I'm focused on outcomes, right? Mm-hmm. So. And then one last thought, you know, when you look at a CISO job description where it requires 15, 20 years in any particular area, don't take it so literally because I didn't fit that requirement when the organization made the decision to bring me on because they were confident in my ability to do the job. And there are alternative pathways to achieve that. And mm-hmm. I think that's really an understanding. Hey, even though I don't fit this one mold or pathway, I can do it my own way and still be just as effective and successful.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, time you can't get back. So am I gonna lose 10, 20 years of my life just to qualify for this one role, or am I going to just go for it?
I like it. You know, if I could take away from that, it's like, yeah, just go out there and grab it. Go for it. That's great. Well, Steve, thanks so much for the time today. Really appreciate stepping away, sharing all your learnings and insights with everyone here. And thanks, everyone, for joining us. For those of you that watch the webcast, obviously you see us here. If you're listening to the podcast, well, there's a whole video that you missed out on with this lovely location that we're at. And hope to see you at the next edition of the CISO to CISO. Thanks all. Take care.